Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter Hai, and I'm pleased to welcome Angela Yocum to the broadcast. Angela is the Global Chief Information Officer of BDP International, a leading privately held global transportation and logistics management firm. Among other responsibilities, Angela oversees the setting and implementation of corporate strategy and several aspects of governance and operating committee functions. In addition to her role at BDP International, Angela serves as a member of the Board of Directors at the Federal Home Loan Bank of Pittsburgh. Prior to her tenure at BDP International, Angela served as the Chief Technology Officer at AstraZeneca, as the Corporate IT Executive and Divisional CIO at Dell, as the SVP of Technology at Bank of America, and as the Vice President of Information Services at SunTrust Corporation. Angela holds a Bachelor of Music degree from DePauw University and a Master of Science in Computer Science from the University of Tennessee. I recently caught up with Angela in her office in Philadelphia, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 4 primarily, IT and business partnerships, as we discussed her unique academic background and the influence it's had on her rise and her role as CIO, her role as CIO on the boards of other companies, and her advice to other CIOs who might wish to emulate her path, as well as a variety of other topics.
The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Red Hat, the world's leading open-source solutions provider. Learn more at redhat.com.
Angela Yocum, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thank you.
Excellent. Well, Angela, I thought we'd begin with your company, BDP International. For those listeners who may not be familiar with it, can you tell us a bit about what your company does?
Yes. BDP provides global logistics solutions to some of the largest companies in the world. We specialize in movements of materials that require special handling. So whether across borders or physical special handling in some sort, of course, we'll move anything. And of course, many of our largest customers are in many different business types. So we serve them in many different capacities. BDP has changed the way its customers think about logistics. I consider logistics to be the final frontier in competitive advantage for many of our customers. Oftentimes you think about logistics as just being the lowest cost play. At BDP, we provide a value that allows our customers to see a rather unique view of the movements of their goods around the world, not just a current view, not even just a rearview mirror view, but some of the things that we're doing inside of the IT shop is related to predictive analytics, scenario planning, looking across total landed cost, enabling better decisions for our customers in the large, so that not just single divisions within a very, very large company, but also better decisions across the entire global organization. So it's an exciting place to be. It allows us, from a seat at BDP, I have the opportunity to see movements, geopolitical changes, opportunities that are emerging in new markets around the world. I get to see the impacts of environmental changes. And it's a wonderful place from which to view the evolving economy and marketplace.
That's wonderful. And I know recent news, in fact, is that you've become the board member of three different subsidiaries of the organization, if I have these correct, BDP Transport, BDP Global Services for Europe, and then BDP Global Services for Asia Pacific. I know it's relatively new news, but can you talk a bit about your responsibilities towards each of those as well?
Sure. So as you may know, BDP International is a privately held company. It is about 50 years old, and it's owned today by a group of four owners, yet we're a very, very large company. So as you can imagine, we have multiple entities inside of BDP International that serve different customer segments and look after many different market segments. Because technology has a very strong role to play in best serving our customers in a differentiated way, as well as expansion into new markets and into new customers, I have an opportunity to then serve on some of those boards. It's exciting. I'm looking forward to it. And my tenure hasn't just yet begun, but it will imminent. I'm looking very much forward to it.
And another opportunity, as you pointed out a moment ago, to get to know the geopolitics and international relations and all sorts of interesting topics that will be related to, especially the international board positions that you have. You have been, Angela, an IT executive in multiple organizations. You were divisional CIO at Dell, you were the CTO at AstraZeneca. You're obviously now a CIO again. You've worked in financial services. You've worked in a range of different industries. And I wonder, as you contemplate your journey, as you look now in the rearview mirror and contemplate the steps along your journey, how have you seen the IT executive role evolve across your experience?
Early on, I cut my teeth. I sort of made my stamp in the industry in the era of cost saves. And at the time, the thinking was always IT is bloated, IT spends too much money. And by the way, we did. The way most businesses had evolved, whether organically with high focus in regional growth or through acquisition, regardless of the method of growth, we tended to end up with a lot of redundancy across multiple regions around the world. I mean, you mentioned some of the places I've been, they're global companies. These are very large entities. And as a result, the focus tended to be, when I was just becoming an executive, how can we reduce the complexity? And it was absolutely the right thing to do at that point in time. It was the right thing to do to free up investment to then spend on more interesting things for the company. But I have to tell you, I don't get too many of those questions anymore. Because on one hand, most companies, and certainly BDP is one of them, has already gone through that process. It's almost retro now to talk about how can we take more cost out of IT. Very few companies, few forward-thinking companies, and even I would say, even just your average company, few of those companies are looking at just a plain, pure cost play in the IT space. They're looking at IT as a differentiating capability for the company. So we do have a lot of conversations about investment. I care very deeply about investment because how we very carefully manage technology investment, not only within the IT division, but outside the IT division, that determines how we are going to pay for some things that are, in fact, differentiating for our customers and for the company as we run our business. So when I look back upon the journey, the biggest change I see is that shift from cost containment to, okay, cost containment's table stakes. We're not even going to talk about that. Let's talk about smart investment. Let's talk about changing the way our customers interact with our company, changing the type of value we provide to our customers. And the easiest and best and most comfortable way to do that for even our customer base is typically through technology plays. So that's a big shift. That's the most obvious shift I've seen. There are similarities, though, that still persist across all the verticals where I've been. And many of them, not to seem like Pollyanna, but I will tell you, IT, especially some of these global companies, they have some really smart folks. And it's just been a wonderful journey for me to work with very, very smart, very driven, very dedicated people across all of these very large verticals. IT in all of these large companies have an opportunity to take deep dives into every single line of business that the company has to offer, into every corporate function. And we are engaged, those of us who care, and I think most senior executives in IT divisions do, those of us who care to can engage as deeply as we wish in the leadership teams of those respective lines of business and corporate functions. There are very few cases in which we get the stiff arm from someone. If we choose to engage and want to engage in a business-focused way, we're always welcome to do so. So I've seen those sorts of themes throughout, and I just wish I saw more IT leaders taking advantage of that opportunity.
You also represent what I find to be the next iteration of the value that IT leaders can provide, and that is that you're on the board not only of the subsidiary, as we mentioned a moment ago, but you're also on the board of Federal Home Loan Bank of Pittsburgh, so an external organization. And this has eluded a lot of talented IT executives in the past for perhaps a variety of reasons. I'd like to understand your own speculations as to why that might be. But before we get there, I'd love to understand, how did this opportunity present itself and why was it attractive?
Like, I can go back and tell you what I understand to have been the process before I joined the board. So what I'm telling you is secondhand. So take it with a grain of salt, I suppose. But the board very consciously sought out candidates who had a strong, broad technology background. It is not uncommon, as you well know, for someone on the board, on any corporate board, to be the supposed tech guy, the tech person. But historically speaking, that person would be pulled from the sales ranks of a large technology company or from some other role within a tech company. And they are smart people, and they are amazing people to have on boards, and that is still the right thing to continue to do in many cases. But if what you're hoping to fill is an actual technology governance role, someone who's going to look after the risk elements related to technology in a company, and someone who's going to drive management of the company to expand in ways that would better serve the shareholders and better serve the customers of that company, then you might need someone who's actually done it from within a very large organization. That is the decision-making process that I think the folks at the Federal Home Loan Bank of Pittsburgh went through when they were determining who are we going to have to fill this role of a strong technology leader on board. That was the thinking in advance. A colleague of mine who sits on the board made me aware of the search, as, by the way, happens when you're looking for a job. It's as with any search. You know, there are recruiting companies that are engaged to fill these positions. Sometimes you hear about them through the grapevine. Sometimes the recruiter calls you. In this case, a member of the board suggested that I put my name in the hat. So I did, and we went through a very rigorous pre-screening process, just as you'd imagine would happen. Multiple interviews. There were many candidates involved. And then, of course, because it's a heavily regulated entity, the regulator had to screen me and ensure that I met the standards of the regulatory body. Once all of that was done, the members of the Federal Home Loan Bank, which are banks, member banks, then voted on the directors they wanted to see added. So there was a bit of a voting process at the end. I suppose I should have hired a campaign manager, but that's the process. What it allows the member banks to do is be fully represented in the decision for bringing on a new board member. I'm what's called an independent director. So if you look at the other members of the board, you'll see many of those members are senior executives, CEOs, executive vice presidents from large member banks or significant community banks. They are also elected, and they're elected as member directors. There are a handful of us that are independent directors. We are truly independent. All of the directors, of course, act in the best interests of the member organizations and in the communities that we serve. I don't know if you're aware of this, but the Federal Home Loan Banks have, as part of their remit, the mission to provide, help support affordable housing in our community. So we care very deeply about seeing investment going into the communities and support for our member organizations who will help along those lines as well. For me, I feel as if not only am I serving on a corporate board and doing all of the things that one would do in that capacity, but also I feel as if it's a worthy, deserving sort of organization for my time and effort. So it's been a wonderful experience.
What have you brought back to your own organization? Is the opportunity to meet with leaders from a variety of different backgrounds and different disciplines and to contemplate the issues of the day, is that something that you've been able to parlay into insight that you then bring back to BDP International?
Well, I think it's fair, absolutely fair to say, you know, anytime we get the opportunity to work with a group of senior executives who come from a very diverse set of experiences and backgrounds and work closely with them in a room for a couple of days around a table, it's a learning experience. I'd like to believe everyone leaves those sessions with something more than they brought in. I'm no exception to that. So it's certainly a personal growth enabler. And of course, that would in turn translate to better work that I can provide BDP.
Do you have any means of speculating why historically CIOs have not been members of board?
Of course, this is just speculation. I think it's in part due to the expectations that we had of CIOs in the past. We didn't expect CIOs to do much more than keep the lights on at a reasonable cost. And we still do, by the way. That's table stake in the CIO game. But the collection of capabilities that a CIO must bring into that role is just so much more broad than it used to be. So it may be something as simple as CIOs that we were homegrowing many, many years ago are just not board-level sorts of people. That could be a very simple explanation. It's probably a bit trite and probably an incomplete one. If I had to attempt to be a bit more sophisticated in my answer, I would also say that it has to do with the recognition by boards, perhaps due to the proliferation of consumer-level technology and its free usage at home and at work and in all aspects of everyone's lives, or whether it's due to a deeper recognition of what can be brought to customers through technology enablement. But I think most board members, most senior executives of companies, and pretty much anyone who walks the earth today now has an understanding that technology is a very, very important and essential element of any business's capability mix. And so that doesn't only translate to making sure you have a very senior capable person at the helm, a capable business leader at the helm of your technology organization, who can also go very deep and understand impact of technology decisions, of course, but also having someone looking out on a governance level on the board for the company's best interest.
I also wonder, as you think about your own experience that has led to the point where it was appropriate for you to be considered and then asked to join a board, for others who might wish to walk in your footsteps, what kind of advice would you offer to other CIOs who have that same ambition?
I'll give you two sides of the coin on that. Yeah. So on one hand, I'll give you a piece of advice that everybody, I think, knows, but I'll say it anyway. And that is, of course, that there is little to no intrinsic value in the technologies that we deliver. The technologies that we deliver must always be in support of a desired business outcome, preferably those prioritized the highest collectively by your company and your senior execs. So everything that we do as technology leaders must be, of course, in terms of the value delivered to the company. And so I think as long as, and this is the one side of the coin, is as long as we continue to put everything we do, whether it's investment, whether it's proposals that involve cross-functional engagement, or any ask that we bring forward to the company or any proposal that we bring forward, must always be in support of that and must always keep in mind that we're here as a business leader. The flip side of that is the only reason that many of us are business leaders is because we're the tech guy. We're there at the table. We can't sit there at the table and refuse to talk about technology. Our job, if we're going to challenge our companies to continue to grow, on the back of the expanding technology capability in the world, there's tremendous advances happening in technology, in all facets of technology. It's our job to challenge the company to take advantage of those advances. And whether we're talking about advances that would be incorporated into our corporate systems for better productivity, or better reach, or more fluidity or flexibility, or whether it's in digital product offerings that we bring directly to the customer and allow them in turn to be more productive, flexible, engaging, and serving their customers and so on. That's why you're at the table. If you're a technology leader, you're the one who's going to be proposing that. If you're not the one proposing great new things, transformational new things based on technology opportunities, then you're probably not doing your job. Those are the two sides of that coin.
Well, I think these are important truths that organizations and IT leaders need to take to heart. And just the fact that you've peppered your conversation throughout about business value, about the need to understand the international components to the job that you have and the way that customers operate. Clearly, you're not somebody who's just thinking about the ones and zeros, but rather a broader perspective. So I know from our past conversations that you have an ambition to become a CEO one day. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, there are others who've taken that path, though, of course, it's not one that's been frequently trodden upon. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about, I think it's very admirable to declare that, to have that as your own personal strategy. I wonder if you could just sort of speak about that ambition.
We all know that companies have different CEOs according to their needs at a given point in the company's life cycle, right? We've seen that since the beginning of time, practically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes you'll see a CEO who's in place to transform the company. Sometimes you'll see a CEO that's put in place to dismantle a company. Other times you'll see a CEO that's put in place to enable a long-term growth agenda. And these are specialties that these CEOs have demonstrated in past roles, whether they're coming from another CEO gig or coming from a COO or CFO gig somewhere else. As we continue to see more companies differentiate themselves through technology capability, we're going to continue to see more CIOs, or people who have led very large technology divisions, move into those CEO roles. And I think we're talking about your CIO plus, your CIO pluses. These are the people who have tremendous vision, who have the personal influence and fortitude to push transformational change through a company and have proven it in their CIO plus roles. These are people who have made the sacrifice, who have led global organizations, who have perhaps governed companies through board seats, and essentially have the credential that any CFO, any head of sales, any COO would bring to the CEO seat. And as technology becomes a more important part of a company's long-term strategy, you'll see more CIO pluses moving into that role, and I think appropriately so. Now, will the CIO plus sort of persona and capability set be the type of CEO to take a company through 20, 30 years? I think no more, no less than any other CEO archetype. But it certainly is becoming more common than it ever has been before. I think it will continue to increase in frequency And I think I'm, if not ready now, then I am on the path. So I see no reason to not make that a goal.
I'm so pleased by the number of CIOs I'm speaking with who are now women and IT executives, the growing ranks of IT women. And you've operated in this function during a time where it's gone from a real paucity of female talent to a growing amount of it. And certainly it's nowhere close to 50-50 in terms of IT departments. But I wonder the extent to which you care to talk about the state of women in IT, where you've seen, how you've seen that evolve as somebody who's worked at all levels of the function, now has multiple times over led the function.
I'm going to have to answer that in two parts. First, yes, there are extraordinary women running IT divisions. They are coming from a variety of backgrounds, and thank goodness that they are, because there aren't many women in a hardcore IT background. But there are IT leaders that have come from many different disciplines. I know you've interviewed many of those leaders, and they're just doing extraordinary work in their respective organizations. The more women we can attract from across the aisle, so to speak, from other groups who have proven themselves as senior leaders, who have the intellectual capacity to grasp the complexity of the job that we have, which is, by the way, a requisite for anyone coming from another division to lead IT, and also the ability to make that transformational change at this point in most companies' IT lifecycle. I will be the first to support that, and I like nothing more than to find other women leaders in the space. The second part of that answer is, we need not only more women leaders, we need more women engineers. We need more female developers, architects, engineers, data scientists, scientists of any sort. This is a known issue. You have, I think, 55%, I heard yesterday from one of my colleagues in academia, 55% of college students today are female. Yet something like, I'm going to get the percentage wrong, but it's in the low teens percent of women in engineering disciplines and science discipline. That is a problem. All sorts of reasons why that might be. I am the least qualified person to speculate, so I won't do that. But that's a problem that concerns me greatly, because what I don't want to end up is in a situation where when someone sees a woman walk into the IT leadership council, they assume she's not technical. That is a problem. I would like to see more women who have deep and strong chops when it comes to technology and can contribute in the deepest and most profound sort of ways as we create solutions that may not be commercially available to us and may need to be created to make a differentiating change for our companies.
You obviously were somebody who studied engineering at the graduate level, but interestingly enough, you studied music at the undergraduate level. And I'm very curious about, A, your path from music into engineering and ultimately into IT, and on the path that has led you to your current role. But also, are there facets to your undergraduate experience in music that you've taken with you that lend themselves well to the posts you've had since?
So full disclaimer, you should know that my dad taught me how to write code when I was 11. So I'm a ways away from 11. I know 11's not a big deal these days, but back in the olden time, 11 was a big deal. I didn't know a lot about systems, but I certainly understood the basics of coding. I certainly knew all the looping constructs and conditional statements and procedural elements and considerations, and I knew those from an early age. I let it drop mainly because I didn't understand there were jobs that did that. My dad taught me to code because he's a smart guy. He was a college administrator. He just so happened to know how to code and taught me. It was a fun thing to do with your daughter, you know, and that's what we did. I went through college as a music major, and I'll get back to some things that I have taken away from that in a minute. But then after college, got back into technology. So first it was just going back, taking a couple of classes, learning new languages, trying to understand something more about systems, understand what this networking thing was. Very high level things. And then ultimately, I had a wonderful professor in night school who worked for NASA in the summers, and he had a couple of different PhDs in different disciplines. And he pulled me aside and he said, you know, you need to go to grad school. So I did. And it was the best piece of advice. I went into graduate school. I had a wonderful couple of advisors at the University of Tennessee in the computer science department. It's a very competitive program. It's a very tough program. Not a lot of women at the time, but I had some tremendous support and opportunity provided to me by the staff there and the faculty there. And the rest is history. From there, I managed to make my way into some very large-scale opportunities. It has just grown from there.
And in terms of what you've drawn from your music background, are there ways in which you've leaned upon some of what you learned as an undergraduate and as somebody who's studied and appreciated music for many years?
I think there are two things that I've taken out of the undergraduate study in music. The first is discipline. So I don't know that it's well understood. Music students practice individually maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 hours a day. So just as individuals practicing their instruments. Then they are in typically several ensembles, so they may have 1, 2, or 3 ensemble practices a day. That's on top of a full course load. So when you think about the sorts of things that student athletes have to do, it's a very similar time requirement. And the sort of things that you learn on a football field, for example, around teamwork and even around competition, those are the sorts of things that we have to learn as we work together in an orchestra or a wind ensemble or a band. And these are lessons that I think anyone coming out of school with a music degree would take with them throughout their lives. That sort of discipline, time management, need to excel, competitive nature, those sorts of things. The second thing I took out of music school is watching some of my professors. These are people, you have to understand, graduating with a music degree, very, very few people get jobs. Only the best of the best go on to get their master's and doctorate and then do postdoc work and eventually become professor for their instrument in a significant music school. And watching these people who were the best of the best, the people who were the top of the game, people who had multiple recordings, people who had ongoing contracts with major studios, with major even instrument producers, watching these people, how they interact with the students, how freely they gave to the community, how freely they gave to the student body well outside their studio, watching the grace with which they interact with their colleagues, watching how important it was for them to give something back to the body of knowledge, the body of work, not only in their discipline, but in other musical disciplines. That was inspirational to me. It's how I strive to be, finding ways to give back to the community, finding ways to contribute to those who are up and coming. This is a passion of mine, and it's one that I took directly from those lessons learned as an undergraduate.
Well, Angela Yocum, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT and sharing quite a bit of knowledge about what has made you the successful executive that you've been. So thank you for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The Forum on World Class IT would like to thank Red Hat, the world's leading provider of open source solutions, for being our corporate sponsor. Red Hat is a catalyst in communities of customers, contributors, and partners creating better technology the open source way. Connect to an ecosystem of innovation at redhat.com today to learn more. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategies' 5 principles of world class IT. The 5 principles are as follows. Principle 1 is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the 3 prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy-setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.